And I want to talk to Joe Doyle from the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts. And here is the story. Quickly, I'll let Joe give you the real rundown. There is a men's march for life. And I didn't know that there was, but there is such a thing. And the Men's March for Life is coming to the to Boston, Massachusetts, on October the 15th. That's a Saturday. So that's 1 week after the St. Benedict Center Conference. And apparently, Cardinal O'Malley is opposed to this. Well, we're going to get to the bottom of this and find out what's really going on. Joe Doyle is the president of the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts, a friend of, he is also the press spokesman for the Friends of the St. Benedict Center. He's a regular guest on media all around Boston. He's a regular contributor via op-eds and letters to the editor to Boston media. And he's become quite a regular here on the Crusade Channel and the Mike Church Show. And we're glad that Joe could take some time out of his day. Joe, welcome back to the Mike Church Show and the, Crusade Channel. I pray you are well this morning on the Feast of the Seven Sorrows of the Blessed Virgin Mary.
Indeed. Thank you, Mike, for having me. I'm always happy to be here.
Well, what can you tell us about the Catholic Action League with your press release, and why is Cardinal O'Malley opposing a march for life?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, but I as shocking and as disheartening it is, the answer, I think, is probably unsurprising. What's happening is on October 15th, there's going to be the Men's March to Abolish Abortion and Rally for Personhood in Boston. This is, I think, the fourth such march. They've had one. They've had one in November of 2021 in Baltimore. They had one in Washington D.C. in June. They had another one in Tallahassee, Florida, in June. This is their fourth outing. The whole idea behind this is to have men step up and take responsibility and resolve to do more to end the scourge of abortion. As you probably know, Mike, you know the pro-life movement tends to be largely kind of feminine and matriarchal in many cases. So this is an attempt to involve men in it. The archdiocese, the supporters of the march wrote to the archdiocese, wrote to Cardinal O'Malley, requesting his support. And instead of a reply, they received no reply. Instead of a reply, on the 16th of August, a statement was issued by the archdiocese under the name of a kind of middle-level bureaucrat, a Father William Joy, who's the assistant vicar general and the vicar for administration, which effectively ordered all the Catholic parishes and all the Catholic schools in the archdiocese not to support the march. And the statement said that Cardinal O'Malley would join the annual March for Life in Washington in January and said the archdiocese would focus all of its attention on that. And then it said, really quite gratuitously and astoundingly, it said parishes and schools may be approached to publicize or support other marches, quote-unquote, but they will not be endorsed by the archdiocese, nor should they be supported by its institutions. So this is clearly kind of targeting the men's march, because that's the only major pro-life event that's going to occur between now and January. We've also learned now that the Pilot, which is the oldest Catholic paper in America, which is the official newspaper of the Archdiocese of Boston, is refusing advertisement for the men's march. And we've also learned that the State Council of the Knights of Columbus is refusing to cooperate, citing the Cardinal's position. So this is really, again, another example of the two-front war that faithful Catholics are fighting in Massachusetts, a war against the culture of death in secular society and the culture of betrayal in their own church. Now, you know, by the way, obviously the suggestion that the Catholic institutions are somehow incapable of supporting two different pro-life marches, which are 3 months apart, by the way, is an example of the kind of, casual dishonesty which we've come to expect from our ecclesiastical leaders. I think there's several things going on here.
Okay.
First of all, the Archdiocese has a long history of withholding support from grassroots pro-life groups. The Archdiocese has carefully delineated limits on its pro-life position, whose boundaries, unlike America's southern border, are strictly enforced. They'll promote their own initiatives, and they'll promote initiatives or involve themselves in initiatives by kind of establishment right-to-life groups that have a history of deference to the Catholic hierarchy, like Massachusetts Citizens for Life, but beyond that, that they won't get involved. They have a long history of cold shouldering, you know, grassroots pro-life groups like Operation Rescue, like 40 Days for Life, like the Helpers of God's Precious Infants. There was an incident some years ago where a representative of the Priests for Life was banned from giving a homily at a parish in Boston, the South Shore. Many pro-lifers remember that infamous incident. I think we talked about it on the radio at the time in 2017, Mike, when the Archdiocese and the Massachusetts Catholic Conference effectively had tried to sabotage a state constitutional amendment to stop the funding of abortion by a signature gathering ban on church property. So they have a long history of, again, of being unsupportive to Catholic groups. The other thing is, I think the men's march has really committed a cardinal sin, no pun intended, in the eyes of the Archdiocese. It's called for the enforcement of Canon 915 of the Code of Canon Law, which prohibits admission to Holy Communion by those in a state of, quote-unquote, manifest grave sin. In other words, the march organizers oppose the sacrilegious distribution of the Holy Eucharist to pro-abortion politicians. Mm. Now, this issue is really kind of the third rail of archdiocesan hypocrisy. Cardinal O'Malley and his top aides wish to present themselves as pro-life, but they've maintained for decades, you know, a very close, very amicable, and ingratiating even, and a kind of mutually supportive relationship with the politicians who enable and who perpetuate and to promote and who expand, you know, the slaughter of the unborn. Under Cardinal O'Malley, Catholic Charities gave not one but two awards to Boston's radically pro-homosexual and pro-abortion mayor, Thomas Menino. The Society of St. James the Apostle, which is a missionary organization whose president is Cardinal O'Malley, gave their Man of the Year award to the fanatically pro-abortion Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, who said he wanted to make Boston a sanctuary city for abortions, and who actually named a square in the city's south end after the notorious, you know, abortionist Dr. Kenneth Edelin. As the Catholic Action League pointed out in a special report we did in 2017, Cardinal O'Malley is probably the most egregious offender in the American hierarchy when it comes to giving awards, unlawfully giving awards, honors, and platforms to pro-abortion political figures. You know, the church, the American Catholic hierarchy has a 2004 statement called Catholics in Political Life, which says you should not give awards, honors, and platforms to those who reject core Catholic moral values. That's just routinely ignored here in Boston. You know, the Cardinal constantly has made public appearances with Mayor Menino, with Mayor Walsh, with Governor Charlie Baker, the pro-abortion Republican. He's brought them to Catholic venues and fundraisers. He did a press conference with Congressman Joe Kennedy, probably outrageously to the pro-life sentiment. He actually attended an award ceremony for Barack Obama at the Kennedy Library. Ugh. He was pictured smiling with Barney Frank, you know, the former Congressman Barney Frank, at a housing development dedication. And then, of course, he also co-wrote, and this is really astounding, the Cardinal O'Malley co-wrote an op-ed piece opposing President Trump on immigration with the Attorney General of Massachusetts, who is Maura Healey, who is an abortion fanatic and a partnered lesbian. So, you know, just by the way, just 6 months ago, the same Father Joy who signed this letter saying targeting the men's march signed another letter to the Massachusetts Pro-Life Coalition saying the Cardinal would not intervene in the decision of Catholic Memorial School to honor Secretary of Labor Marty Walsh. So, for the Cardinal and the Archdiocese, these cozy, chummy, you know, friendly relations with these pro-abortion falls has had some benefit. You know, it means, help with fundraising. They bring them to these fundraisers like the celebration of the priesthood dinner. It means favorable media coverage. You know, Cardinal O'Malley has never gotten the cardinal law treatment from the Boston Globe. It means tax dollars for Catholic charities. And I think some of us believe it also means easy municipal approval for the kind of real estate development transactions that keeps the Archdiocese afloat. If you look at the recent budget of the Archdiocese, the only reason they run in the black is they're liquidating property. And they're selling off, former land, buildings, churches for these major, real estate redevelopment projects. And that requires in Boston the approval of the mayor through the what used to be the Boston Redevelopment Authority. It's now the Boston, I think, Development and Planning Authority. So, again, these cozy relations with the pro-abortion falls, are a financial benefit to the leadership of the church. I think you also have to bear in mind that it's really, people think of Cardinal O'Malley as kind of historically pro-life. He's a liberal, and it's a liberal archdiocese. His closest advisor his father, Brian Hare, who was the, you know, the reputed author of Cardinal Joseph Bernardin's seamless garment doctrine. You know, the seamless garment was this ideological contrivance intended basically to destroy the pro-life movement. And it would do so by trivializing abortion and by reducing abortion to just one of several issues, really of the same moral importance as, say, health care, housing, social welfare, the care of immigrants, and so on. And then, you know, in 2020, after the George Floyd incident, the cardinal actually suggested America was indeed systemically racist and said that the killing of African-Americans by police officers was all too familiar and that racist premises are woven through our basic structures. He's called for reparations. He supports, obviously, liberalized so-called immigration reform. You know, his tepid, low-key statements on pro-life, like the one that came out after the Dobbs decision, always seem intended to kind of reassure progressives that despite his opposition to abortion, he supports them on everything else. So I think after, you know, the Cardinal O'Malley has been here for 19 years, I think we can reasonably assume that he and all of his aides are bourgeois liberals. They're comfortable with, you know, pro-abortion elites, and they're completely disdainful and uncomprehending towards the kind of ordinary faithful Catholics who are conservatives, who are Republicans, or who are, heaven forbid, you know, Donald Trump voters. You know, culturally, socially, and politically, I think the sort of Catholic who's likely to participate in the men's march is an alien species to the Archdiocese of Boston.
Well, and Joe, one of the things I think we can take away from this, as you just described it, and one of the other things that I can tell you personally, my friend Michael Hitchburn, the founder of the Lepanto Institute, he was in the Men's Life for March, Men's March for Life in January of this year, and I talked to him about it, and there were hundreds upon hundreds of men that showed up for this, specifically for the reason that that men feel, as you said, that they're not doing enough, and they're certainly not doing enough publicly to let everyone know, anyone that has an interest in the issue of life, and everyone should, that it's not just Catholic women, it's not just evangelical women, it's not just Protestant women, that there are men that care deeply and just as much, maybe even more, about protecting the lives of the innocent and the soon-to-be-born. You know, and I remember, because I interviewed you leading up to that dinner that they were going to have at the Knights of Columbus Hall, where they hosted Marty Walsh, and where he got that award. You may not know this, Joe, but many of our listeners did something that you requested of them, or you suggested, which was, we went to the Knights of Columbus site. I wrote the Grand Knight a note. I wrote him a letter, Joe. I told him, I said, I am a third-degree Knight of Columbus, and this is an abomination and an outrage. You're scandalizing me. And I also wrote a letter to the Knights of Columbus Grand Knight in the state of Virginia when they hosted Tim Kaine, and they were going to give Tim Kaine an award. And there were thousands of us in that one that wrote a letter and said, this is not acceptable. You cannot reward these people that are for the butchering and the dismembering of the soon to be born. So I think really that's what that's what the cardinal and with the bourgeois liberals, as you correctly referred to them, are really afraid of. And this is how Our Lady works, though. She works in small numbers. You don't have to have number. So the fact that the cardinal has actually put this on his radar screen and has singled it out tells me that these men are going to do an awful lot of good in your city. And I might even be able to hang around and join the march on October the 15th, because it's just one Saturday after the St. Benedict Center Conference, Joe.
That would be wonderful, Mike. I'm sure they would appreciate your involvement. And, you know, we're just one of the best ways to counter this betrayal by the Archdiocese of Boston and by Cardinal O'Malley is to make the march a great success and for everyone to participate.
Joe, I also want to talk to you about your previous press release. Catholic Action League calls for Bigot to be fired, fined, and decertified. This is about a Connecticut school administrator, Jeremy Boland, who admitted on videotape they intentionally discriminated against Catholics that applied for teaching and other positions at a school. And as you suggested, every person, every Catholic that ever applied for any position at this school should have some recourse against this creep.
This is unbelievable. Can you imagine if he said this, we have to discriminate against African-Americans, we have to discriminate against Jews? we have to discriminate against Muslims. They would have fired the guy in a heartbeat. The fact that he's been suspended, I think, with pay, and he's being investigated by the Connecticut State Board of Education and by the Department of Education, rather, and by the Attorney General's office. It's absolutely outrageous. He actually advocated. He said he would never hire Catholics. He said you have to avoid hiring them. He said they're all rigid and so on. And Title VII of the United States Civil Rights Act of 1964, specifically prohibits discrimination in employment based upon an individual's religion. The state of Connecticut has prohibited discrimination in public employment based on religious creed since at least, I think, something called the Merit System Act of 1937, and then that was followed up by a Fair Employment Practices Act in 1947. And, of course, that act actually said that the definition of an employer in Connecticut law includes the state of Connecticut and all political subdivisions thereof, meaning school districts. And it actually said that religious discrimination in employment is a constitutional rights violation under the Declaration of Rights of the Connecticut Constitution. So this is absolutely egregious, outrageous. What he did was not only unethical and immoral. It was illegal. It was unconstitutional. He's a barefaced bigot. He broke the law. He abused his public trust. And he violated the civil and constitutional rights of American citizens. And he deserves to be removed from his position and banned from his profession and legally punished, legally sanctioned for his unlawful behavior. And by the way, he mentioned that he's hired four or five people, and there's been almost 30 people, applicants for each job, which means Connecticut is almost 40% Catholic. So just, mathematically, the number of people there had to be a number of Catholics who were rejected by him. So they should sue. And by the way, he's not only a bigot, he's a would-be totalitarian. The reason he's opposed to hiring Catholics is because they might sympathize with the concerns of parents, and they might not be on board with, aggressively promoting transgenderism, so-called, in the schools. So he's somebody else who wants, he thinks that public schools are a platform to indoctrinate and sexualize minors and usurp the right of parents, to really control the upbringing of their own children. This guy should never be permitted near a school again. His name is Jeremy Boland, by the way. And again, he's been suspended, but he should be fired, and he should be decertified as a teacher by the Connecticut Department of Education, and he should face civil and criminal penalties for what he did.
It's amazing that the only legal form of discrimination that is permitted in the United States today is bigoted discrimination against people who publicly affirm that they are Catholics. Now, of course, this is now expanding if you publicly affirm that you are a Make America Great Again supporter. That would identify you. You can be bigoted against them as well. But to identify, and as you said, Joe, if this was done to a Muslim, I would imagine that Merrick Garland would already have opened the civil rights investigation, and that the Justice Department would already be teeing up fines. The EEOC would be there on site, and in a very short order, that school would come to look like a madrasa. It would look like a Muslim school where imams are trained.
Yeah. What's the old saying? If liberals didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all.
This is true. Hey, Joe, I know you got to go somewhere and get, so I'll let you go. I just wanted to curiously just ask, have you seen or read anything about the upcoming Supreme Court case, the one out of North Carolina? Harper I can't remember who it is. Moore versus Harper.
I have not.
This is a case right up your alley. You should look it up. Moore is the Speaker of the House of the North Carolina Assembly. The Assembly, by their constitutional right, redrew congressional districts based on the 2020 census. Out-of-state groups, nonprofit NGOs, and a couple of angry, ugly women. And some minorities decided that they were going to sue the state of North Carolina. They lost in a lower court, and then the North Carolina Supreme Court sided with them and get this, Joe, said that it was up to the people of the state of North Carolina to determine those the congressional districts, and they had a little council that they put together of all these various and sundry professional grievance groups, and they redrew the map, gave it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said this is now the congressional map. So the Speaker of the House of the Assembly of North Carolina said, no way, no way. And he appealed a writ of certiorari, and Justice Alito accepted the case, and arguments will be heard next month in October. This is the case, though, that the court could have heard after the debacle that happened in the 2020 presidential election. This is the kind of case that could have been heard. Now it's finally going to get a hearing. The only question that remains is, are there five votes to do the right thing? Article 5 and Article 7 of the Constitution clearly delegate specifically and exclusively all power over elections and any appointment of any kind, a federal election, clearly is delegated to the states, the state legislatures. The state legislatures can ratify amendments. The people cannot. So this is a huge, huge case, because if it goes 5-4 for the Speaker of the House of North Carolina, then states would then be free basically to go like, yeah, we're not going to honor Obergefell, for example, anymore. So I would love your legal opinion on this, or I'd like to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, you know, first of all, obviously, since 1789, it has been prerogative of the state legislatures to draw congressional districts. So that, you know, it should be a slam dunk in one regard, simply because there's absolutely no precedent for a non-legislative actor to apportion U.S. House seats in a particular state. It's clearly part of the sovereign prerogatives of the legislatures of the 50 states. In terms of its other implications, I'd really want to know a little more about the context of the case before I would comment. But in terms of the authority of state legislatures to draw congressional districts and apportion members of the U.S. House of Representatives, this is a precedent that's 230 years old, and it is clearly defined in both the U.S. Constitution and in state law. So the right of the legislature to draw congressional districts, I think, is unassailable.
Well, let me just, and I look forward to you reading up on it, and then we can have another conversation about it. But just remember, in the Dobbs case and in the ruling where Justice Alito, where he pointed out, not only was there the text of the actual Constitution that would pertain to Roe, and that there was nothing there to suggest a constitutional right to kill the soon-to-be-born. What else did Justice Alito point to? And this is why I think it goes at least 5-4 for North Carolina. Joe, what else did he point to? He said tradition. He said tradition. There is simply no legal tradition in the United States to show that states lose or surrendered their prerogative to regulate life and death situations like abortion. So there is no tradition whatever to suggest that the state legislatures don't make the rules for drawing congressional districts.
Right. And by the way, it's also the tradition that all laws regarding abortion and all laws regarding marriage are the prerogative of the legislatures of the 50 states.
That's right. All right. Well, yeah. Joe, as always, thank you for your great. You know, I talked to Brother Andre Marie yesterday, and I was singing your praises. I said, as I've gotten to know Joe over the years, and he's become a regular guest, I said, not only is Joe the smartest guy in the room and a walking, talking encyclopedia, and that's a good thing, on things that you want to talk to him about, I said, but he's also a lion for the faith. The man never rests. So, Joe, tell folks how they can get in touch with you and support your wonderful apostle at the Catholic Action League of Massachusetts.
Well, you can reach us at our website, which is www.catholicactionleague.org, www.catholicactionleague.org, or you can send us an email at catholicactionleague@gmail.com. That's CatholicActionLeague@gmail.com.
All right, Joe, I know you got to go. Thank you very much. I'll see you next Saturday.
Mike, thanks very much.
I'm sorry, three Saturdays from now. Not next Saturday. I'll see you three Saturdays from now.
Great, Mike. I will look forward to it, Mike. Thank you for having me, as always.
And I'll make sure you get a copy of this so you can share it with your readers.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
All
good
right.
luck.
All right. Yeah, you're welcome. God bless you, Joe. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike.
All
good
right.
luck.
All right. Yeah, you're welcome. God bless you, Joe. Thank you very much.